This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Termed combative resistance. An internal investigation cleared the officers of any wrongdoing. Cox's attorney, Jason Kafouri, has obtained video footage of the incident from a nearby bar, which does not show Cox fighting with the police. After reportedly suffering injuries from the incident that resulted in losing his job as an iron worker, Cox is seeking $400,000 in non-economic damages from the city and $120,000 in lost income.
Today, the Portland City Council voted to amend city code to require on-site parking for large apartment buildings. The original amendments proposed by Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability create minimum parking requirements for buildings over 30 units. Commissioner Nick Fish modified the proposal into a tiered parking system that would change the parking requirements based on the size of the building. Under Fish's plan, buildings with at least 30 apartment units would require one parking space for every five apartment units. The ratio would drop to one parking space for every three apartment units on buildings with 50 units or more. The law will take effect in 30 days.
Dog owners found chaining their pets for extended periods may soon face criminal fines. Today, the Oregon House passed a bill that outlaws restraining a domestic animal on a leash less than 15 feet or more than 5 hours in a 24-hour period. If the tether is attached to a zip line, the pets cannot be chained for more than 10 hours at a time. House Bill 2783 also bans tethering conditions that could result in strangulation of the pet, such as the use of choke collars or tethering in a location with obstacles. Violators could be charged with first-degree animal neglect if the tethering results in serious injury or death and face fines of up to $1,000. The bill, which passed the House with a vote of 45-14, now heads to the Senate.
Growing class sizes and aging technology are the focus of separate local option levies being considered by two school districts in Washington County. Last night, the Hillsborough School Board had a lengthy discussion about putting a levy on the November ballot. While no final decision has yet been made, the majority of board members expressed support for choosing the flexibility of a levy instead of a construction bond. Hillsborough School District is facing $8 million in budget cuts for the 2013 to 2014 school year. Meanwhile, the Beaverton School District has a five-year option on the May ballot, which provides an additional $15 million a year. The Beaverton School District is also facing cuts of up to $15 million in the upcoming budget year.
In 2006, California passed the Insurance Non-Discrimination Act, ensuring that transgendered people will have access to the same medical care as any other insured person. Despite the passage of this act, transgendered people are frequently discriminated against, dropped from policies, and denied access to basic medical care. This week, California's Department of Managed Health Care issued a directive to enforce the earlier act, a major victory to transgendered Californians. KBOO's Jennifer Kemp spoke to the trans justice manager of Basic Rights Oregon, Tash Schatz, about what's going on locally to stop discrimination against trans people in healthcare.
Talk about the memo that recently came out reinforcing the California law saying that transgender people cannot be denied healthcare for necessary procedures.
So just this week, California came out with some fantastic news. The Transgender Law Center and other transgender advocates in California have been working to ensure that transgender people have access to the same medically necessary health care as all Californians. The Department of Insurance, I believe, in California affirmed that plans can no longer be sold under their jurisdiction that contain discriminatory exclusions around the medically necessary health care that transgender Californians need. So this is really an affirmation of equity in the type of care that all Californians will have access to.
Why was the original 2006 law so frequently ignored?
The 2006 California law?
Yeah, because I know that what the memo is just reinforcing a law that already existed, but insurance companies were frequently ignoring that.
That's a good question. My understanding is that this is a clarification of the law, so it's likely that prior to this clarification, insurance companies did not understand the law in that way.
Does the discrimination against transgendered people in the medical system happen more by doctors or by insurance companies? Where does the root of the problem lie?
Insurance and medical discrimination against transgender people is really a multifaceted issue. So I would say that there's, you know, an equal level of importance in having medical providers who understand the care that they need to provide to trans patients and can be respectful in providing that care as they would be to all patients, and in insurance company and insurance policy language, including the health needs and the medically necessary care that transgender people need. So these are both really important issues. I would say equally important issues.
Basic Rights Oregon is working to get a similar law passed in Oregon. What kind of work is your organization doing?
So we've actually worked with transgender folks in Oregon and our insurance division to clarify our non-discrimination law in the state. And in December, the insurance division here, through the Department of Consumer and Business Services, released a clarification stating that insurance companies in the state can no longer deny care to transgender patients that would be provided to non-transgender patients. So this is a really important victory for the transgender community here, and we're seeing this kind of across the country in California, Washington, D.C., and Colorado.
And what is the relationship, if any, between this issue and the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2014?
Well, the Affordable Care Act in 2014 will ensure that nobody can be dropped from an insurance plan for pre-existing conditions. And this is an issue that we know many, many transgender people face. So many transgender people are dropped from insurance plans altogether or denied the sale of an insurance plan simply because we are transgender. So our gender identity has been seen as a pre-existing condition. Because of the insurance division bulletin here in Oregon, that will no longer happen. And in 2014, the Affordable Care Act will ensure that that no one can be dropped for a pre-existing condition, including transgender people. What's really important to note about this issue is just that healthcare for transgender people is really an important part, a hugely important part of how we can function in the world and participate. There's extremely high levels of discrimination in employment, for example. 90% of transgender people reported being discriminated against in employment on a survey conducted by the National Center for Transgender Equality and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. And we know that housing, employment, access to basic services, access to participating in society are all deeply connected to healthcare. So the impact that these kind of bulletins that are happening, you know, here in Oregon, in Colorado, Washington, D.C., and California, the impact is huge for transgender people because it means that we can have equal access to the same coverage that non-transgender people have. And when we are able to access the health care that we need, the medically necessary care that we need, we can really live fuller, happier, and safer lives. And so it really benefits everybody in these states when folks are being treated equally.
This is Jennifer Kemp with KBOO News.
A Washington florist who refused to provide bouquets for a same-sex wedding is heading to court. Yesterday, Attorney General Bob Ferguson filed a lawsuit against the florist under the Consumer Protection Act. The Attorney General's office seeks to force the business to comply with state anti-discrimination laws and impose a $2,000 fine for every violation. Before filing the suit, Ferguson had sent Washington florist Baronelle Stutzman a letter asking her to reconsider her refusal. Stutzman, who refused to provide the floral arrangements in early March due to religious reasons, has decided to take the matter to court. Her attorney is seeking to move the case to federal court, where he will argue for her freedom of speech.
Washington State University professor David Warner was beaten on March 30th and remains in critical condition in a hospital in Spokane. Warner was caught in the crossfire trying to intervene in a fight between an acquaintance of his and a group of college-age people in a parking lot on College Hill. Warner is Native American and teaches critical culture, race, and gender studies. Although police deny the assault as being race-motivated, University President Elson Floyd is creating a commission on campus climate focusing on issues of race and marginalization at Washington State University. Many students there at the college have speculated that Warner may have been beaten because of his race.
On Monday, a Seattle school official pleaded guilty to 36 counts of theft. 60-year-old Silas Potter was in charge of a program to help businesses owned by women and minorities receive more contracts. King County prosecutors accused Potter of signing off on $2 million in questionable deals and using dummy businesses and fraudulent invoices to funnel most of the funds. Sentencing is scheduled for late May, where prosecutors are seeking 3 to 5 years in prison.
This year, there'll be no U.S. Navy ships during the annual Fleet Week at Portland's Rose Festival due to sequestration budget cuts. However, the U.S. Coast Guard and Canadian Navy will both still be in attendance, as will historic ships moored to the Willamette River. Budget cuts have also forced the Navy's Blue Angels to cancel all of their scheduled appearances this year, including the one at the Oregon Air Show.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Right to Survive Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is a chance of showers with temperatures in the mid-50s.
It is 5:15, time now for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It was a gala evening of celebration, libations, commendations, and insidious corporate cynicism. Hosted in March by a financial trade publication, this annual Black Tie Awards dinner on Wall Street made news when the award for Best Crisis Management was handed out. Yes, an award actually exists for what amounts to PR deception, deflection, and dissembling by a corporation that has been caught making the year's biggest honking boo-boo. For example, the 2012 prize was taken by GE for its razzle-dazzle ducking and dodging over the fact that its reactors were at the core, literally, of the Fukushima nuclear nightmare in Japan. Equally stunning was this year's awardee, J.P. Morgan Chase. America's biggest bank was fated for its handling of last year's embarrassing discovery that, oops, investors lost $6.2 billion in bad trades made by one of the bank's chief investment arms. Accepting the award for its media hocus-pocus, a Morgan executive quipped, "Crisis? What crisis?" Such gaiety, such absurdity. Especially since a U.S. Senate subcommittee had just issued a devastating 300-page report showing that Morgan's destructive corporate culture of greed and deception caused the loss, and that the bank's top executives repeatedly misled investors, regulators, and the public at large about what really happened. Not only did they mislead, but they did so illegally, for it's against the law for investment banks to make untrue statements about the risk of the securities they sell. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Wall Street narcissism appears to be an antidote to personal embarrassment, for Morgan's jolly bankers showed up to collect their crisis management award, even though everyone knew by then that they had grossly mismanaged their crisis. Wall Street is not merely absurd, it wallows in its absurdity.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The latest release in WikiLeaks history came out today. Known as the Kissinger Files, the trove is more than 350 gigabytes and includes 1.7 million diplomatic cables covering the years from 1973 to 1976. with over 200,000 files associated with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, the release continues the trend of large amounts of former secret information being brought to light by groups such as WikiLeaks. The last few weeks have seen other large releases of information, including a report from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists that explores secret offshore bank accounts. Other information obtained by Sunday Radio Television Suisse led to the resignation last month of the French budget minister, Jérôme Cahuzac, who was forced to resign after allegations of secret bank accounts, which led to his being investigated by the French government.
Job prospects for new college graduates remain dismal. A new study issued by the Economic Policy Institute illustrates that the new workers will continue to face lasting impacts from the Great Recession. Recessions typically hit young workers harder on average than the broader labor market, but the slow recovery from the most recent downturn has magnified its long-term effects. In March, the unemployment rate for workers under 25 was slightly over twice as high as the national average. Oregon's young workers faced the second highest underemployment rate in the nation. It was 34.6% in 2012, second only to Mississippi. Unemployment for Oregon's young workforce was double the overall rate of 17.2%. KBOO reporter Quinn Reed spoke to Heidi Schierholz, an economist with the Economic Policy Institute and an author of the report.
What were some of the major findings, or perhaps what were some of the findings that particularly struck you as important?
I think a key finding from this is that things just haven't improved that much over the last year. And actually, that's pretty consistent with what we've seen in the broader labor market. You know, we have all seen the unemployment rate come down. The national unemployment rate is down to 7.6% from its high of 10% in October of 2009. That sounds like a lot of improvement. But when you dig down in, it turns out it's happened for all the wrong reasons. That decline in the unemployment rate at the national level has largely been due to people either dropping out of or never entering the labor force because job opportunities are so weak. That's not the kind of improvement in the unemployment rate that we want, but that's what we've gotten. And then I think there's one other key point that this study brings home is that there is not something unique going on that is just slamming young workers in particular in this downturn. Young workers, the unemployment rate of young workers is always higher than the unemployment rate overall in good times and in bad times. And what we have now is an unemployment rate that is just extremely elevated.
So for students who graduate into this kind of low wage, low opportunity situation, their prospects long-term are also going to be diminished. So I was hoping you could speak to that a little bit.
One thing that happens at a time like this is a thing economists call cyclical downgrading, that young people, actually people of all ages, but this particularly hit job seekers and all of these young people are often looking for their first or second job. Cyclical downgrading is you take a job that's below your skills or experience level. So this is the classic story of the college grad who's working as a barista. So that's one of the things that contributes to just not getting your foot in the door on the career path that you want to be on. Young graduates, people who enter the labor market in a period of weakness, so the class of 2009 through likely the class of 2016 are entering the labor market when job opportunities are scarce. That means they're going to have to accept lower-level jobs at lower wages with worse compensation packages. They're very likely to experience a period of earnings and employment instability. So young people often have extended periods of employment and earnings instability. They're more mobile, more likely to spend some periods in unemployment. But for people who enter the labor market during a period of weakness, that period of earnings and employment instability is much longer than otherwise, much more severe, much more volatile. Some bit of good news is that the evidence suggests that these workers will eventually catch up to the happy trajectory they would have been on if they had been able to enter the labor market and the sort of happy alternative universe when job opportunities were strong. So it is very likely that they will ultimately catch up, get back on that trajectory, but it will take a very long time. It's likely to take 10, 15 years on average for this cohort to catch up. They're never going to get back that lost earnings. They may get on to the trajectory that they were otherwise would have otherwise been on, but that whole period where they're earning less money, they're not going to get that money back. That could be a down payment for a house.
You know, is there any improvement or what is the outlook, you know, from here on out?
The answer is yes, they are getting better, but at a snail's pace. The improvement is happening very, very slowly. And so I can appeal to, because we know that the trends for young people generally track the trends overall, I'll appeal to what we think the outlook will be in the broad labor market, and that's also going to be true for the labor market outcomes for young workers. In the first quarter of 2013, the overall labor market added, on average, each month, 168,000 jobs. So we get, on average, our monthly growth rate was 168,000 jobs per month so far in 2013. If we maintain that growth rate every single month from here on out, we will not get back to the pre-recession unemployment rate until the end of 2019.
That was KBOO reporter Quinn Reed talking to Heidi Shierholz with the Economic Policy Institute.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. Israeli troops kidnapped 23 Palestinians in morning invasions targeting West Bank communities, and tanks invade parts of Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers kidnapped 23 Palestinians in different parts of the occupied West Bank after breaking into their homes and searching them on Wednesday morning. One of the kidnapped is former political prisoner Tha'er Halahla from Hebron, who conducted a 78-day hunger strike last year, protesting his two-year administrative detention without charges. The Israeli army freed Halahla in July 2012 in return for him ending his strike. Halahla's sister told local news that soldiers violently attacked him and confiscated his computer and mobile phone. Moreover, Halahla's wife was moved to a local hospital after suffering nervous breakdown after the soldiers kidnapped her husband and attacked her. Earlier on Wednesday, the Israeli army invaded an area near Hebron in the southern part of the occupied West Bank and demolished a well, a hut house, in addition to uprooting some trees owned by local farmers, local sources reported. Elsewhere, several armored Israeli military vehicles and bulldozers invaded on Wednesday morning Palestinian farmlands east of Khan Yunis in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Local sources reported that two armored D9 bulldozers, supported by four tanks, invaded the area while military choppers flew overhead, and that the army fired several rounds of live ammunition while uprooting and bulldozing farmlands. The sources added that the invading military vehicles were based at a military base across the borders east of Khan Yunis. On Tuesday morning, the army invaded the same area and bulldozed dozens of dunams of Palestinian land. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, April 10th News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hossam Kassis and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, yesterday, two U.S. service members died in a NATO helicopter crash in eastern Afghanistan. Four Afghan police officers were killed and two injured when their vehicle struck an IED in southwestern Afghanistan. On Tuesday night, Taliban insurgents killed two Afghan police in an attack on a checkpoint. Also on Tuesday, an Afghan soldier opened fire on NATO troops from Lithuania, injuring two. Today, the last of Britain's Royal Marines left Afghanistan. 40 Commando was the first British unit to be deployed to the war in Afghanistan. The end of their tour marks an end to over a decade of Royal Marines fighting in the area.
Former Oregon Secretary of the House Lynn Lundquist died yesterday morning. He was 78. The Crook County resident served two terms in the House, one of which as Speaker. After losing a bid for Oregon Secretary of State in 2000, he became the first leader of the Oregon Business Association. He was elected Crook County Commissioner in 2008.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Quinn Reed, Jemiah Cherry, Jimmy Tardy, and Jennifer Kemp. The producer is Zeke Harrington. The KBOO Interim Evening News and Public Affairs Director and our engineer is Rebecca Ney. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Nia Lewis.
And I'm Brian Pridgett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock, Dave Mazza hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, on A Deeper Look, Linda Olsen Osterlin examines the hunger strike at Guantanamo Prison and the Day of Action by supporters. She interviews Pardis Cabrie. At 10 o'clock, hear Flashpoints Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, join host Dan Johnson on Between the Covers and meet Portland icon Paula Nielsen, also known as Sister Paula. She has a new book out titled Trans Evangelist, The Story of Her Life. She'll talk about her early life while still known as Larry, her years in Los Angeles, as well as the years she spent working at Darcel's in Portland. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you did miss it, however, no worries. You can still contribute at kboo.fm. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News, and have a great evening.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 10th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama releases his $3.7 trillion budget while it eliminates subsidies to fossil fuel companies and raises some taxes. Critics say it fails to address the root causes of U.S. debt, and plans to cut Social Security will hurt the nation's poor. Advocates join the family of a 16-year-old shot and killed by U.S. Border Patrol agents in Nogales. They're calling for a full investigation and an end to abuse and shootings. And we'll go to Indian-administered Kashmir, where residents are pushing for police to stop the use of pepper gas following injuries and several deaths. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Thousands of immigrant rights advocates are in Washington, D.C. today demanding lawmakers maintain forward momentum on the issue of immigration reform. The All In for Citizenship rally is being backed by unions, faith groups, and human rights organizations across the country. Attorney Nick Katz with Make the Road New York says the Obama administration's deferred action status for immigrants brought to the U.S. as children is buying much-needed time. But he says Congress needs to repair the broken immigration system and improve on this temporary fix.
I mean, it's giving them work authorization, which is incredibly important, and it's giving them some protection from deportation, which is also important, but it's not giving them a path to citizenship, which any kind of comprehensive immigration reform that's being talked about would do.
Congress is expected to consider both Republican and Democratic proposals for immigration reforms in the coming weeks. After a special election Tuesday, Chicago will have a fresh face in Congress. Former Democratic state lawmaker Robin Kelly handily defeated Republican opponents to replace Jesse Jackson Jr. Jackson resigned in November, citing mental health issues and a federal probe into misuse of campaign money. FSRN's Jay Saper reports.
Robin Kelly wore her F rating from the National Rifle Association like a badge of honor in a district that has been ground zero for Chicago's surge in gun murders. Kelly was quick to defend $2 million in campaign funds from New York Mayor Bloomberg's super PAC, saying it was fair play against the NRA. Although Kelly rallied support with vows for tougher gun laws, she made it clear she was not blind to the district's deeper needs.
We won't stop until jobs come to our communities. We won't stop until we create a real path to citizenship for the millions of immigrants working hard. And we won't stop until critical improvements finally come to our schools.
Kelly's district has also been plagued by political corruption. Jesse Jackson Jr.'s two predecessors were also forced out of office by scandal. Jay Saper, FSRN, Chicago.
The Russian Ministry of Justice has filed charges against the election monitoring organization Golos under a new law requiring many NGOs to register as foreign agents. The group is the first to be charged amid a massive government inspection of more than 200 human rights and other social justice groups across the country. From St. Petersburg, FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
Under the law passed last November, any organization engaged in political activity that receives financial support from abroad must register as a foreign agent. Inspectors say Golos received money from the Norwegian Helsinki Committee, which gave the group the Sakharov Freedom Award in 2012.